Hi, Chris Bentley here. Thanks for downloading this episode of Here and Now Anytime. We have some great stories in the works, deep dives on the arts, the environment, childcare, and much more. To get those, plus the top news of the day, make sure you subscribe or follow us in the app of your choice. Just search for Here and Now Anytime. And if you're already subscribed, I'd love it if you told a friend about us. And thanks. Now here's the show.
There is a real issue of the insurance market in California grappling with climate change, and an increasing number of homeowners are unable to find insurance on the private market.
Wildfires are making it harder to buy a home in California. It's Monday, June 5th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, Walmart jobs pay a lot better than they used to. But a new book says recent wage gains don't make up for decades of big companies squeezing workers.
We've dug such a deep hole and we can't do things incrementally anymore if we're really going to fix this wage crisis in this country.
The limits of socially conscious capitalism coming up in about 12 minutes. But first, we've got two stories on how wildfires are reshaping life from coast to coast. Smoke from several wildfires in Nova Scotia, Canada, has drifted all the way down to Virginia. Several fires have raged there for more than a week and destroyed hundreds of homes. One of the fires, which is now contained, forced 16,000 people to evacuate their homes in the capital, Halifax. And earlier today, Scott Tong spoke with the mayor of Halifax, Mike Savage.
How much did the rains help over the weekend?
Well, the rain certainly helped a lot. We had a very hot week last week, so the fires started a week ago yesterday in Halifax. This is so. There's Nova Scotia. Halifax is a urban, suburban, and rural population. The fires started Sunday night, and then we had a hot week, but also a very windy week, which really drove the flames, very high, and into neighborhoods, subdivisions where we had to evacuate people. So on the weekend, for sure, the rain helped us a lot, and we're expected to have rain on and off for a few days.
I understand one wildfire in Shelburne County, the Barrington Lake Fire, is the largest ever recorded in Nova Scotia. Has that been contained yet?
I don't think it's been contained. It's a certain percentage under control. I don't know what the number is. It has been a very tough year. Just as a context, we found out yesterday that Nova Scotia has lost 27,000 hectares of land, of woods, to fire this year, and the average is below 1,000 for an entire season. So this is very dramatic for us.
Yeah, wildfires do occur in Nova Scotia. Why is this such a horrific fire season?
A couple of reasons. We didn't have a particularly brutal winter like we sometimes have, so the ground wasn't soaked with snow and ice and consequently water, so it was a bit of a weird season. We just had, it doesn't take very much to start a fire, and when it starts in the woods and there's fuel there, wildfires just have a life and a will off their own. But what I think really we were calling this one is a wind-driven fire. And so when it's hot and dry and windy, those are the perfect conditions, the perfect fuel conditions for a fire to take off. And that's what we saw here in Halifax and in Shelburne a couple of hours to the south.
I understand many who evacuated their homes in Halifax are starting to return to their homes. But in the hardest hit areas, what are the critical needs people have?
Well, yeah, so there was overall over 16,000 people evacuated. There's now about 5,000 people, I think, that are still out of their homes. And in some of those areas, although we've had rain and the fire is considered managed, there still is the potential for flare-ups. There's fire guys tell me up here that they've seen fires hide for weeks underground. So that's an issue, but water quality is a big issue. Air quality is a big issue. This is not an area that is serviced by city water. This is mainly a well, so people have to be very careful about the water. We want to test all the water before people go back in. We're working with our provincial government, Department of Environment, to test the water. There's debris. There's a whole host of different challenges that come as people start to move back into these neighborhoods.
Yeah. And briefly, Mayor, I'm down in the Mid-Atlantic in the Washington, D.C. area where the smoke and the air quality warnings have come all the way down. We are all connected here, are we not?
Mm-hmm. We sure are. And as you would know, wildfires are just taking off. I mean, we had the horrific fires in Fort McMurray a few years ago. There's fires mm-hmm. out of control now in Ontario and Quebec and BC and Alberta and probably other places. With the changing in the climate, not only are we getting, fires mm-hmm. that we haven't seen before, but in the fall we had Hurricane yes. Fiona, which is the third or fourth hurricane that we've had in the last mm-hmm. 5 or 6 years, which used to be once in a 100-year thing. So the climate's changing, and we have to be prepared for it.
Mike Savage is Mayor of Halifax. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you very much.
And wildfires are also starting to force some major changes to how California homeowners get insurance. After the break, Robin Young hears how regulators there are warning of a looming insurance crisis. Stick around.
Well, State Farm Insurance has announced it won't accept new applications for homeowners insurance policies in California because of the cost of California's wildfires and floods. Allstate had already paused new policies. Some new homeowners in California are going naked. That's industry talk for they're going without home insurance. Let's bring in Bloomberg's Eliyahu Kamischer, who covers California. Eliyahu, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, I'm better, I guess, than homeowners in California. No new policies from State Farm anywhere in California. Even homeowners who don't live near areas that have, been prone to these terrible wildfires or floods. Tell us more about their decision.
Yeah, so State Farm is the single largest provider of homeowners insurance in the state, and they said that they need to be pricing the risk of climate change and wildfires into their plans, along with the increasing costs of rebuilding homes in the state. So if a home is burnt down, the insurer is on the hook for the cost to rebuild it, and that has become a lot more expensive as well.
Well, State Farm and other insurers in California had rate hikes in the past. The company was asking for a huge new rate hike, over 20%. They didn't get that. Do you think that influenced their decision not to offer new policies?
State Farm hasn't commented on that, but it is pending, a 28% rate hike. Allstate, which also left the state last year, is requesting 40%, and that's those are both pending. So those are big increases, and consumer advocates are a bit wary of that request. They say that while climate change is real, they might be using that as a cover to kind of seek as high of a rate increase as possible. But there is a real issue of the insurance market in California grappling with climate change and rising costs to rebuild homes, and an increasing number of homeowners are unable to find insurance on the private market, and State Farm's exit makes it a lot more difficult.
You talk about critics being skeptical. State Farm was worth over $130 billion in 2022. But on the other hand, a spokesperson with the Insurance Information Institute, you write, says that in the last 6 years, they've lost 20 years' worth of underwriting profit. It's hard to believe that a company would leave a state as big as California with all the profit it could make, unless they weren't making that profit.
Yeah, it is a huge market. There's 40 million people here, about. And the state has seen, in the past 6 years, some of the worst fires in its history. The 2018 Camp Fire was the deadliest and most destructive in the state, and they've taken billions and billions of dollars in losses. So there is this issue where it's becoming more risky to insure homes in California.
There has been protection for homeowners from the rate hikes that the insurance company has been sending out. Proposition 103 dates back to the 80s. It's said to have saved customers tens of billion dollars. What does it do, and why are insurance companies criticizing it?
It creates a lengthy regulatory process. It forces the insurance industry to really kind of provide a public accounting of what rate hikes they're requesting and why they're requesting it. And it actually creates a process where the public can intervene and question the assumptions of these rate hikes that are very complicated. And there's a lot of kind of assumptions that go into a rate hike. So they're essentially saying that this process is really cumbersome. It can take them years sometimes to get a rate hike that is above 6.9%. If it's below 6.9%, then they don't need to go through as lengthy of a process. And so they're saying that this law, which the state has said is really good for Californians, it's one of the reasons why homeowners insurance is on average lower than the rest of the country. They're saying that the law needs to be, looked at or reassessed, and they're putting pressure on the insurance regulator to, approve rate hikes that are pretty high. One lawmaker I spoke with who represents part of Napa County, which has had some devastating wildfires, said that really the industry and the regulators need to kind of come together and find a middle ground. In his district, a lot of people are going without insurance, and he called that going naked, and he said people would be happy to pay higher insurance rates. They just want to be covered in the first place.
Well, to get a mortgage, you have to have insurance, right?
Yeah. So if you want to secure a mortgage with the bank, you need to show proof of homeowner's insurance. The bank is on the hook for that investment as well. And so if you're unable to provide homeowner's insurance, you can't get a mortgage. You would have to pay all cash, essentially. And that's becoming an issue for Californians as well. We talked to one real estate agent in San Francisco, which is, not in the wildfire danger zone, but he said they've already heard about multiple cases where someone's trying to buy a home and they can't find an insurer. So this was really a problem in wildfire zones, and it seems to be kind of expanding a bit throughout the state.
Bloomberg's Eliyahu Kamischer on State Farm Insurance no longer offering new homeowner insurance policies in California because of the high cost, because of the disasters there. Eliyahu, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Walmart has undergone a remarkable transformation, according to one reporter. Once the Death Star of low-wage work, America's largest employer has started to pay more. But after the break, we'll hear why that change might actually show the limits of socially conscious capitalism. Stick around. Walmart recently announced it's raising wages for more than 7,000 opticians and pharmacists. Its press release calls the move, quote, another step in our strategy to offer good jobs that lead to great careers. That kind of language is a far cry from where the company was 20 years ago, when it was gobbling up huge swaths of the retail economy and getting media coverage like this. Walmart is so powerful that it moves the economies of entire countries, bringing profit and pain. The prices can't be beat, but the wages can. That line comes from a 2004 story in a series by the LA Times that won the Pulitzer Prize. And the editor of that series, Rick Wartzman, continues to report on the company. Now he's out with a new book that tracks how Walmart, once infamous for its low wages, has started taking better care of its workers, and why he says that's still not enough. Wartzman's book is called Still Broke: Walmart's Remarkable Transformation and the Limits of Socially Conscious Capitalism. And he tells Scott Tong there were a few reasons why Walmart started to raise its wages.
One was outside pressure, right? These unions, politicians, journalists, right? Pains with a pen, like my team,
yeah.
That had been at the LA Times and many others. The interfaith community, also really important. The nuns who show up at shareholders meetings and press for positive social change. All of these were factors leaning on Walmart. It makes it harder for Walmart to expand into certain urban areas. They were, over the years, denied access to different locations by city councils. And so it was having a business effect. The biggest thing, though, I think, is Walmart had cut their labor costs so close to the bone, starting in around 2011, really accelerating by 2013. Stores were dirty, shelves were bare. Turnover was so high, the churn was so high, people just coming in the door and then quitting in a hurry. And so I think investing in workers became a business priority.
Mm. Walmart's wages are now in this neighborhood of $15 an hour. And you have long suggested in your previous writings, Rick, that corporations can possibly be a lever for social change, that they control such a big piece of the economy. And yet the title of your book is Still Broke, that as much as Walmart has done or perhaps was forced to do, it's not nearly enough?
That's really where I came out. And I think you framed the bottom line really well. This is a company that when they began to raise wages in 2015, their average starting wage at the time was $7.65 an hour, barely over the federal minimum wage of $7.25. By the way, the federal minimum wage still today and has been at that level since 2009. Yeah. So long, long overdue for an increase. But Walmart moved so that their average wage is $17.50 an hour. Mm. But here's the rub. When you look at that average Walmart worker, even at $17.50 an hour, that pencils out to less than $33,000 a year. And that's not a living wage, really, anywhere in the country. And that's sort of why I came to this conclusion that corporate America, if you look at Walmart, the biggest employer in the country, right? It's both a source of this problem and a symbol of something bigger. Corporate America will never move far enough or fast enough on its own.
Walmart is almost showing signs of getting there, and yet you say that's not enough for the vast majority of American workers?
Yeah, that's right. And what we're solving for, just to be clear, is the need to share the fruits of the nation's growing economy and growing productivity more broadly, right? To share economic prosperity more broadly. But again, when you just do the math, there's something that's just wrong. And I began to look across the economy and realized, you know, there are tens of millions of people, tens of millions of workers who get up every day, go to the job, do all the things they're supposed to do, and yet at the end of the month often face these really painful trade-offs because they are just struggling to make ends meet, right? Over the last 50 years, we've just dug a hole that is so deep as an economy, as a society, that, again, I think the Walmarts of the world and by extension most of corporate America, they're approaching this too incrementally. And they're confined by the pressures of Wall Street, by their own business models and so on. They just are never going to go, as I said, far enough, fast enough. And so now I would lean more on the government side to try and help lift people up.
One third of the country, you just wonder how that strikes you, and if it does the way it strikes me, a third of the country makes less than a living wage for a family?
By my analysis and looking at a lot of different scholarly research, somewhere between 25% and 40% of the U.S. labor force really struggles to make ends meet. They are one, you know, blown carburetor, one missing days at work and falling behind on their bills from really spiraling into crisis. These are people who are, you know, often described as living precariously. They're really right on the edge. And I believe a living wage in this country is $20 an hour, which is maybe sounds shocking when our federal minimum wage is still at $7.25.
Yeah.
But I think if you look at it and you say, what does that translate on an annual basis? If you work full time, right, it's a little over $40,000 a year. That is not, in my mind, a lavish life anywhere. Good policy, I think, promotes family formation. And so when you get to $20 an hour, you begin to get to what I would call a family living wage, where two working adults with a couple of kids could actually support and sustain that family.
At the end of your book, Rick, you have this fascinating example of this $20 an hour appearing to work. I believe it's in Denmark where, you know, McDonald's workers make $20 an hour and it still works for the management, it still works for the corporation as well?
It does. Look, these are trade-offs. Again, the economy in this country has grown tremendously over the last 50 years. What has stopped happening is those gains are no longer shared broadly. They're almost all going to the top 1%. most people have been left behind. They're not getting their fair share of putting in that labor. If you look at other societies, there is more broadly shared prosperity. Their shareholders get less. Corporations take lower profits. It doesn't mean they're not profitable, but there is less of an expectation that profit will be maximized, if you will, really at all costs.
What kinds of government intervention make sense to you?
The biggest thing, I think, and the most straightforward thing is to mandate a living wage. Again, I call for $20 an hour. Again, we've dug such a deep hole and we can't do things incrementally anymore if we're really going to fix this wage crisis in this country. And I can already hear the critics. Would there be some job loss? Undoubtedly. There are issues of wage compression, right? What do you do with the folks who are already making $20? Suddenly, the guy next to me who was at minimum wage is now making $20. Do I get a raise too? There's lots of pieces of this that would have to be carefully thought out and implemented. But the measure of good public policy is not, is it perfect? It's, will this benefit a lot more people than it harms? And I believe that going to a true, genuine living wage in this country would be a huge benefit for way more people than would be hurt.
The book is Still Broke: Walmart's Remarkable Transformation and the Limits of Socially Conscious Capitalism. And the author is Rick Wortsman. Rick, thanks for the time.
Hey, thank you so much.
You can read an excerpt of Still Broke at our website, hereandnow.org. And while you're there, check out our other stories. Today, we look at the origins of the group PFLAG, which originally stood for Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. They've been advocating for LGBTQ+ people since 1973. Back then, Jean Manford's public support for her gay son was considered radical, but that didn't deter her.
We will fight for the rights of our children. We will become political. We will have a national organization. I remember thinking that at the very beginning.
You can find that conversation at hereandnow.org. This show comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Sam Rafelson, Gabrielle Healy, and Shirley Jihad. Today's editors were Gabe Bullard, Julia Corcoran, Peter O'Dowd, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Theme music by Mike, Max, and me. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.